Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
I think they have the heater on or something.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, we're back, and to prove it, we're here. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Paulina now in Noblesville, Indiana. Hello, Paulina.
Hi, Mr. Madrid.
Madrid. How old are you?
9.
Awesome. I remember being 9. Are you in the 4th grade?
Yep.
Yep. I was in the 4th grade when I was 9. Probably my favorite year of school. So tell me, what's your question?
If God created everything, then who created God?
Oh, I love this question because it sounds like somebody had to create God, right? Because everything has a creator. Everything that exists was created by something before it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the answer to the question, try to think about this. The answer is nobody created God. God has always existed. God has
really?
Always existed. Yeah, it's amazing. Now, I'm going to give you an example that maybe will help you understand it. You ever been with your mom and dad in the car and you have to stop because there's a train going across the road and they've got those blinking lights to stop the cars from going so the train can go by? Have you ever seen that?
I don't think so.
No? Have you ever seen a train? Have you ever watched a train go by?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have seen the train, but I don't think we ever stopped for a train to pass.
Okay, fair enough. Well, chances are someday you will, but you've seen a train go by. So let's go to the very back of the train, that last car. Do you know what we typically call the last car on a train? Starts with a C?
I don't know.
Caboose? Does that, you know that word, a caboose?
A caboose?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a funny word. But that's what they call like the last car on the train. Now, you'll notice when the train goes by, that last car is moving, right? It's moving. But why is it moving? Why is that car, the last car on the train, moving? How can it move? It doesn't have an engine in it. So why is it moving?
Because the first part of the train has this thing to move the rest of the train.
Perfect. So you got right to the heart of the answer. I was going to say that car is moving because it's connected to the car in front of it. It's hitched up to that car, and that car is pulling it. But that car is only moving and pulling the caboose because the car in front of it is pulling it. And you have to go all the way to the front of the train and get to the engine that is pulling all the other cars. That's how trains work, right?
Yeah.
So there's nothing pulling the engine, is there? That engine is moving on its own. So it has the ability to move on its own. Doesn't need anything else to pull it. It can move on its own. And because it can do that, it can pull all those other train cars behind it. You see how that works? Okay, so now think about God. This is kind of like that. That all those trains on the car are all the creatures in the universe. All the planets and galaxies, even the universe itself, you and me. Everything in the universe, we're all like those train cars. We were all moving because our parents, you know, we came into this world because of our parents, and they came into this world because of their parents, and God made the planets and all that. But there must be some cause that doesn't need to be caused by anything else. It just exists. And if it didn't, then nothing else could exist. Those train cars could never move. They would just sit there if there wasn't an engine at the front that had the power to pull them. So that's how we can know that God has always existed. He must exist, otherwise nothing else could exist. That's one way to think of it. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad. And you know what we just did? Here's a new word for you. Are you ready for a new word?
Yeah.
I bet you'll be the only one in your fourth grade class who will know this word. Here it is. Metaphysics. Say that.
Metaphysics.
Metaphysics. Metaphysics.
Metaphysics.
Metaphysics, yeah. So when you get a chance, maybe your mom will talk to you more about that. Metaphysics is the study of why things exist, how they exist. What does it mean to exist? And that gets us to the issue of God, who he actually is existence itself. God is existence. I know it's hard for us to imagine it. We can say it, but it's hard to imagine it. But you're now doing it, 9 years of age, you're doing a little bit of metaphysics. And maybe when you get older, you'll want to do more of it. It's a wonderful thing to study. And you just got your first lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope that helps, Paulina.
It does.
Good. Here's something else. Is your mom right there where she can hear what we're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, Mom, listen to this. I think that Paulina is not too young to listen to the Aquinas 101 videos on YouTube. They're put out by the Thomistic Institute. They're all about 7-8 minutes long. And they have videos, these Aquinas 101 videos, on this very topic. How is it that God exists from all eternity? What does that mean, even? And they're very interesting to watch. It's not just a talking head. There's, you know, interesting graphics and things going on. So, Mom, what I would recommend is maybe watch one of those with Paulina. I have a feeling that that's going to be able to take her deeper into some of these issues. And what a beautiful thing that you're so young, Paulina, and you're already thinking about these issues. That's great.
Yep. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Say a little prayer for me, please. I would appreciate that. And thank you for calling. Let's go to Barbara now in Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Oh, Patrick, let me put you off speaker, please.
That would be great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for all you do for us. And I wanted you to explain this to me. Is it ever okay to play Mass and hear pretend confessions? Here's the situation. When I was a little girl in the 50s, we used to play, my cousin used to play Mass, and he would distribute pretend communion, which in those days was a Necco wafer, and we would go to pretend confession. It was always, I disobeyed my mummy, you know, just simple things. We were little.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and that's what he used to do. And guess what? He's a priest today. He just loves, you know, he loves that, and it started when he was very, very little. And my little 3.5-year-old grandson is very, very much in love with the church, Our Lady, and our daughter bought him a play kit. They have play kit masses for little ones. And she's explaining the different things, and he watches the Mass on TV, but most importantly, they take him to Mass, and he loves it. He just loves it. He's very, very into holy things. And
I think
so
I can answer your question.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off, but I thought you were done. So you're asking, is it okay to play Mass, dress up and play Mass and use Necco wafers? I used to love Necco wafers when I was a kid. Get a lot of bang for your buck with that candy. The short answer is yes. It's fine, especially if a little boy wants to dream about being a priest and think about it, because especially if he's an altar server, he's right there at the altar. He sees the priest doing this. So there's nothing blasphemous about it. It is actually a beautiful thing for a boy to want to do that. So I personally would have no objection with that. And there are even, I don't know the name of such companies, but there are companies that actually sell like little pretend Mass kits for boys who want to play, you know, like with simple vestments and a little altar. And, you know, it's clear that this is for the purposes of learning about the Mass and thinking about being a priest. So nothing blasphemous, but I think it's fine.
Okay. I was just wondering, because I didn't hear all of this, the previous caller about, and then when you said about something, she said something about stealing communion. I might have misunderstood that, but anyway, I thought it was she stole hosts or something. We didn't do any of that stuff. And right. Ronnie's been a priest now for over 40 years and a very good priest. And our little baby, we pray that he'll have a holy vocation because he just loves church. He loves Our Lady. He sleeps with his Bibles and everything. He's 3 and a half. Okay, Patrick, that's all. Thank you for everything. And one more thing I just want to tell you very quickly. Sure. I so appreciated when somebody asked you, where does it say in the Bible that life begins at conception? And you explained how when Our Lady, you know, right after the angel appeared to her, she ran in haste. And it takes, scientifically, it takes a couple of days for the egg to travel down or whatever. I don't know the whole ins and outs. And it, like you said, it was no more than a couple of days. And I never heard that. I think that is wonderful. You should put that out in a book because, but I don't understand how people don't know about conception beginning life. I don't understand. God bless you, Patrick. We love you. And I pray to you for you every day. And I think you're going to be not only going to heaven, but I think you're going to be a saint in heaven because you give so much of your life up to for us to lead the right way. God bless. Take
care.
Barbara. We love you.
Thank you. I love you right back. Appreciate the kind words and the prayers more than anything else. Thank you. Well, we'll see about that. I'm aiming for heaven, and together we'll all get there with keeping our eyes focused on Jesus and loving him and trusting him and doing our work in the meantime. Thank you so much. 888-914-9149. Dominic in Chicago. It's good to have you on the air.
Hi, Patrick. Just calling in today to talk about obedience. So I know that St. Thomas Aquinas has written about obedience and righteous disobedience. I'm not sure if that's the exact term that he uses. You know, here in Chicago, we found ourselves in kind of a precarious situation. You know, post motu proprio traditionis custodis, we've gotten the heavy hand on any of the parishes here in Chicago that celebrate the Latin Mass. And just as of Sunday, we have the provincial headquarters for the Institute of Christ the King Sovereign Priest, which is an order that solely celebrates the traditional Mass.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Well, they're as of Sunday, they have no faculties in Chicago. So that provincial headquarters, the Shrine of Christ the King, is now useless, right? So, you know, millions and millions of dollars from the laity and hours, right? Lay craftsmen donating their talents to that parish. And, you know, it's hard to keep the anger and frustration righteous. So my question for you is, you know, what advice would you have for the laity that would like to get the attention of Cardinal Supich that he might open his heart and his mind, right? Because we've done rosary rallies outside of the cathedral every day or every weekend, I'm sorry, for a year or 2 years now. And it seems as if he might just be peering out his window and laughing at us. So just not quite sure what the righteous path forward is in resistance.
Okay, fair enough. And I'm very familiar with everything you just described, from a distance, of course, just reading about these things. The only answer that I can give you is the same answer I would give to anyone else under these circumstances is be faithful, trust in the Lord, wait on the Lord's timing, and pray. Continue praying. The fact that you are praying for your bishop is a very good thing. We should all pray for our bishops. Every single Catholic should be praying for his bishop every day. And in the meantime, especially if you feel that a decision that a bishop is making is the wrong decision, then pray that if indeed the Lord wants this to change, that he will make it change. I don't believe in quote-unquote resistance in the sense that I think you're saying it, Dominic. I don't adopt that view myself. The bishop has the right to make changes, or the authority, I should say, to make changes. And some bishops make really wise and prudent decisions. Some bishops don't. Some bishops make bad decisions. And it comes out later, that was really a bad decision. So that's my advice. I know it may sound like, oh, just pray. Well, in a way, but prayer is the most important thing you can do. It's the most powerful thing that you can do. Remember, Our Lady said, pray the rosary. So even though things may seem very difficult, and I could easily understand how people on the ground may feel about this, don't let your anger carry you away. And I definitely do not recommend resistance, if by that people mean demonstrating or, you know, just those kinds of things tend to make matters worse, in my view. They don't tend to make matters better. So I empathize with where you're coming from, Dominic. I do. But the best thing you can do is to remain faithful and patient and long-suffering. And you know what I do, Dominic? I'm not suggesting you do anything that I myself don't do. If I'm in a similar situation, I say, Lord, this is your church. Obviously, this is not my church. This is your church. You established this church. You're the one building your church on the rock of Peter. And if it is your will that your church go through this particular episode in this particular way, then so be it. May your will be done. And I don't understand why, but I'm not supposed to understand why. I trust you, Jesus, and I'm going to remain faithful to you, and I'm going to be obedient in all the things that I should be, and I'm going to wait for divine providence to unfold. That's what I try to do in a difficult situation, Dominic. So that's my heartfelt advice to you.
Understood. Understood. Thank you, Patrick. Yeah, it's in a situation with, we've seen so many liturgical abuses, right, here in Chicago go viral. And, you know, not even getting any commentary on that liturgical abuse at all, you know, from downtown at the Arch, you know, it you start to feel like you might be in like a bizarre world or something. So, but I do appreciate your advice and always faithful. No doubt
about
it.
That's right. Yeah, we should always be faithful and always be not let our emotions run away with us. You know, one thing we can thank God about, Dominic, is to whatever extent we may see problems among bishops and clergy, etc., let's just be thankful that we're not living in the Middle Ages, because there were some truly horrendous examples of bad bishops and corrupt cardinals and murders and all kinds of crazy stuff. And I think just to take the long view historically, we have it rather easy nowadays by comparison. So,
right. All right. All righty. Well, thanks again, Patrick. Thanks for everything you do. God bless you.
You got it, Dominic. God bless you, too. Great to talk to you. And I'm going to be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls and, yes, your emails. People love the emails. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. You can also send me a note at Patrick Madrid. I'm sorry. That's my Twitter address. Go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can send me a note there, and I'll do my best to answer it. I'll be right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't? Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
A couple quick things. I was thinking about our last caller over the break, and he mentioned feeling anger. So let's talk about that for a minute. My number is 888-914-9149. If you want to call, I'm ready to hear your comment or question. 888-914-9149. First thing I want to mention is that St. Thomas, in his Summa Theologiae, he has a section on anger. And I'm going to retweet a tweet that I had put out a while ago. I just retweeted it. And there's a link to what St. Thomas has to say on the topic of anger, and it's worth your time to wade through it, because kind of a short form point here. He's saying that, yes, anger can and often is a serious sin, but not always. He says sometimes it is appropriate to be angry. And in fact, he says that sometimes if you don't have a certain kind of anger, a righteous indignation kind of anger, then you'll never do anything of value. You'll never rise to the occasion to protect somebody. You'll never rise to the occasion to thwart some kind of evil. You'll never rise to the you'll never rise to the occasion to maybe see something bad in yourself and be angry about it and take steps to correct it. I mean, those are some examples that St. Thomas gives. So there is a kind of righteous anger, but we have to recognize it for what it is, and also not make the mistake of thinking that just because you're angry that that is okay because you're angry about something maybe that has to do with God. You can indeed sin in that regard. So check it out. It's from his Summa Theologiae. It's the second part of the second part. It's question 158. And if you want to read it easily, I put a link to it on my Twitter feed. You can find it there. Also, I want to share a book that came out years ago. Probably now it's close to 10 years ago. It's called Overcoming Sinful Anger. And it's published by Sophia Institute. You can get it at your local Catholic bookstore. But if you have a problem with anger and you want to learn how you can curb it, maybe you're just like you're always angry, or you get angry very easily, or your anger taints relationships. Maybe the anger harms your marriage, or it drives your children away from you. These things happen. Maybe get that book. Or maybe if you're married to somebody who's got a real anger problem, get that book. Now, I don't benefit in any way from this. I'm just aware of the book. I have it in my library, and I found it useful. And maybe, I mean, if you say, well, I'm not an angry person, maybe by reading this book, you might uncover a little bit of reality about yourself that you're not aware of. Perhaps other people think, why is she always angry? And you don't even notice it. So that could be a useful tool. Again, the book is called, where is it? It's called, I just had it here. Overcoming. Yeah. You want to say it, Cyrus? You go ahead and say it.
Overcoming Sinful Anger.
Right. And if you can put a link to that, Cyrus, that'd be great.
Done.
Awesome. You're so quick. Let's go to Lindsay now in Pawtucket. Are you in an aviary at a zoo or something?
I'm sorry. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to fix my phone up. Hold on 1 second. I'm sorry.
Wow.
I'm back in my car. I'm so sorry. 1 second.
It's okay. I feel like I'm in Jurassic Park or something.
I can't even find my phone.
I'm in a Costa Rican rainforest.
This is kind of fun to listen to.
I'm in a Costa Rican rainforest.
Okay,
right
here
now.
Here I am.
Whoa, it's okay, Lindsay. That won't work, though. We can't even really hear you. Can you move to a quieter place?
Is this better?
Yeah. Yeah, that's better.
I'm sorry about that.
It's okay.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
All is forgiven.
I was calling because I appreciate you taking my call. My brother's getting married, my younger brother, next month. And I was asked to be in the wedding along with my children and my husband. And we have a pretty big extended family. And all of the nieces and nephews and in-laws and outlaws, everyone was asked to be in the wedding except for my sister-in-law. And so it's been kind of weighing on me of whether I'm being complicit by being in the wedding or should I still just be in the wedding? It's not even my business. I didn't really know how to handle it. I know it's upsetting to her that she's the only one not in it.
Yeah, so this is not an issue that he's getting married in a way that the church doesn't. So in other words, he's getting married properly, right? He's getting married in the church?
In the Catholic Church, yes.
Okay. So the issue is, should you accept the invitation to be in the wedding party, even though the sister-in-law that you just mentioned is not invited to be in? Is that what you mean?
Correct. She's the only one in the whole family, purposely not invited to be in.
And is there any reason why?
Because the bride is, like, the bride and her don't, like, get along, like, extremely well.
Okay.
And, but I mean, like, I'm not great friends with her either. So it's just kind of, that's her reasoning. But
I
makes me feel bad because, again, it's like everything we're doing, all the celebrations, you can see she's kind of on the outskirts. It makes me feel bad. And I didn't know the best way to handle it.
So the bride is going to be your sister-in-law, right?
Correct.
Sounds like? Okay. Well, I mean, this is one of those unanswerable questions. I don't really know what to say. A couple possibilities. One would be to ask her, just for the sake of family harmony, can you just grin and bear it and have her in the wedding party? Would that be possible? Maybe it's not possible. She may just put her foot down and say no. Another possibility would be you could say, I'd love to be in the wedding party, but I feel torn because this other sister-in-law is not in the wedding party, and I feel like I should maybe hang back with her to show her that she's important too. I mean, it seems to me that no matter which way you go, somebody's feelings are going to be hurt. But if you were, if you wanted to show solidarity with the sister-in-law who's left out, that would probably irk the new sister-in-law to be, and that's not good. I just don't know what the which way is going to amount with the most good. Which way are you leaning
on
this?
That's what I've been struggling with.
Yeah.
I really am so just because it's been weighing on me for a while because like they've been engaged for like over a year now. And so in the beginning of this, I kind of was like, when I knew this was all happening, it was like, do I say something? Do I not? Like, I didn't want to cause more division or like drama or anything. And so I kind of like held off on it. And then as things are getting closer, like we just had the wedding shower and we're having the bachelorette party, all these things are kind of happening.
So are you officially, her line dropped. I guess the Costa Rican rainforest didn't have good cell connection there. Well, I'll just have to go based upon what you said. I can understand how tricky this would be. I mean, it's too bad these things happen. So maybe one idea would be to talk to the bride-to-be and say, I realize this is your day. It's important to you. Is it possible that you could make some room for this other sister-in-law so she doesn't feel excluded and insulted as a result of that, which she does? And see what she says. Maybe she'd say, well, okay, you know, maybe she's a really nice person deep down and she'd be willing to swallow her pride and willing to do that. That could happen. It could be a good thing. The other possibility that comes to my mind would be if you realize that by the other sister-in-law being the only one who's left out, that if you were to say, well, then I think I'll opt out too as a way to show some solidarity with her, that would be a beautiful thing too. But then again, the bride-to-be might be irked by that. So I think the best thing would be to get it out in the open and not tiptoe around it and to let her know this is hurtful. Is there any way we can fix this? And please don't be hurt if you're not willing to fix it. You know, if it's not within your ability to allow this other sister-in-law to be part of the wedding party, then I totally understand it and I support you because this is your special day. This is your wedding. And I want it to be perfect for you. So I also want to kind of have solidarity with her. So if you don't mind, doesn't mean I don't love you, doesn't mean I don't care about you, doesn't mean I'm not going to be there to celebrate, but I will hang back and not be in the wedding party and I'll go sit with her just so she doesn't feel like a pariah, which is not good. And maybe the bride will, maybe her heart will melt and say, oh, well, okay. You know, that could happen. So get it out in the open, talk about it. Everyone's an adult, and hopefully there will be some really good breakthrough. That's my prayer. Sorry that we lost the connection. I don't know what happened. Let's go to Richard now in New Jersey. Hello, Richard.
Oh, hi, Patrick. It's funny. I listened to the end of the previous conversation, and you were talking after that about anger. Yeah. Well, I was angry when I called, and not particularly at you, but you made a comment that things were, you know, they're better today in the church than they were back in the bad old days of, you know, murderous popes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But immediately comes to my mind the pedophile issue. And I don't know why, it hits me immediately. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is we still have serious problems, and that's very serious for a man who's been molested by a priest or, you know, anybody else for that matter. Mm-hmm. But I know three men. I was never molested, but my older brother, and I'm 83 years old. Okay. My older brother was molested back in the early 1940s in Brooklyn.
Wow.
And It was he was molested. He went to confession. Well, the whole story is he was molested by my uncle. And he told
Your
my
uncle
mother
was the priest?
About it. And I'm sorry?
Your uncle was the priest?
No. No, he's just my uncle.
Okay.
So he was molested. My uncle lived with us for a while at that time. I was like a baby. Okay. I was born in 1939. But this was the early 40s. And so my brother told my mother about it, and she sent him to confession. He went to confession, and the priest that he confessed this to, as if he had done something wrong, said, meet me at 4 o'clock. And he molested my brother and continued to do that. Well, my brother became an atheist, hated the church all his life.
Yeah.
He died that way. I know a guy I was in the Navy with who was molested by a Boy Scout leader. He, too, was an atheist. And I know somebody else that was a Catholic, altar boy, the whole bit. By the way, my brother was an altar boy at that time. Mm-hmm. And he was molested, and he is afraid, he can't get himself to go inside of a Catholic church.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is this stuff does permanent damage, especially to men. I know there are some women that have been molested. I don't know their story, but I know most of the children molested by priests were boys. And they got to live with this. And I just get the feeling that the church wants this issue to go away. And, you know, they used to pray about it in church after the scandal was out in the newspapers. But gradually, they just stopped praying about it. These victims are still out there. And, you know, they do compensate them. They give them, you know, maybe therapy if they request it. They actually offered my brother therapy. He was in his 80s at the time when he finally started talking about it.
Richard, if you don't mind my interruption, what you're saying is very important. I do have a break coming fairly soon, so I just want to, first of all, express my deep, heartfelt, sincere sorrow that this was done to your brother, that this crime was committed against him, and the effects it had on him, but also all the rest of you and your family. I can only imagine the damage that it's done. And I hear what you're saying, and I think you're right that for some people who have gone through this, maybe most of them, it causes irreparable damage, and they feel estranged from the church. They feel estranged from God, even like your brother, you said, became an atheist. This is why Jesus said, as you know, woe to that man by whom these scandals come. It would be better, you know, rather than scandalizing one of these little ones, if someone does that, it would be better for him to have a millstone hung around his neck and be thrown into the sea, Jesus says. Jesus invokes capital punishment, by the way, in that passage, saying it would be better for that to happen than to scandalize one of these little ones. So it is a grievous, heinous situation, no doubt about it. This much I can tell you, though, Richard. It may be true. And in fact, I firmly believe it is true in a few cases that I'm aware of where bishops, cardinals, I'll leave it at that, want to sweep these things under the rug and pretend that they didn't exist and let's get on with business. But I don't think that the majority of bishops are like that. And I don't know the majority of bishops personally. I do know a fair number of them personally. And in my humble opinion, I've discerned in them a sincere desire to do the right thing and to root out this evil from our midst and to do everything possible to make it never happen again, please God. So I understand your grief. I understand your anger. I really do. But the best thing I can suggest in this point is that, as Jesus said, we have to learn how to forgive. And sometimes forgiveness seems the most impossible thing to do because the person who did the crime isn't even sorry for it. But yet Jesus says we're called to forgive. And I'm trying to learn that myself. So I just offer you those thoughts, Richard. I'm not really sure what else I can say.
Well, that's plenty. That's good. I really just wanted to vent, and I did.
Yeah.
And I appreciate your comment. And I know there are good bishops out there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you.
I'll go with that.
Yeah, thank you. And be assured of my prayers for the repose of the soul of your brother. I'm hoping and praying that he had a deathbed conversion, a last-minute conversion, and knowing God's mercy and love, I wouldn't be surprised.
He might have. We did. He couldn't respond very well, but I did ask him if he was sorry for all the bad things he did in his life, and he said yes.
That's good.
So that was enough.
What is his first name that we can pray for him?
Michael.
Michael. We will pray for your brother, Michael. May he rest in peace. Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
Okay.
Hang in there. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Hello. Hello again.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Real life solutions you can believe in. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We are back, and I'm happy to take your phone call at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I have a note that came in from Bernadette, listening in Minneapolis. Thank you, Bernadette. About Eucharistic miracles. She says, first, I'm in the middle of reading the Confessions of St. Augustine right now, and I agree it is a thrilling book. Well, I agree with you on that, that's for sure. I'm wondering about how Eucharistic miracles relate to transubstantiation. If transubstantiation means that the host has become the body of Christ while still keeping the physical properties of bread, and the host suddenly begins to bleed, for example, doesn't that mean that the host now contains some physical properties of the body of Christ as well? So then, is this still transubstantiation? I was at Mass this morning, and the priest at my parish mentioned that tests had been done on some of the miraculous hosts. He said that these studies show that the hosts have cardiovascular heart tissue, which I think is beautiful, that we are receiving the heart of Jesus in the Eucharist. I don't know much about DNA studies, but I believe that every one of our cells contains our entire set of DNA. In this case, wouldn't it be possible for scientists to determine Jesus' DNA based on these Eucharistic tissue samples? Thanks for all you do, Bernadette. Well, Bernadette, you're raising a really wild, mind-blowing kind of theoretical issue here. I'll return in a moment to the issue of transubstantiation and the appearance of bread and wine, etc. But if, in fact, let's take, in the case of a Eucharistic miracle, which the church says, okay, this miracle, this really is a miracle. We deem it to be beyond the ability of science to explain it in some natural way. What does that mean now that we have the medical scientific power, knowledge, and knowledge equals power in many ways, we've already mapped the genome. We already now understand, at least we think we understand, I'm sure there's a lot more to understand, but we understand now what the genetic code is and how its instructions, its information, and it will actually replicate cells to do certain things, certain functions in the body, etc. I mean, this reminds me of, I remember having my mind blown when I first saw Jurassic Park all those years ago. What was that, Cyrus? 25 years ago, something like that, whenever that came out? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was at least 20, maybe longer. And I remember I'm sitting there in the theater watching this, and they have like a mosquito in amber, and they were able to pierce into the amber, and because the mosquito had been perfectly preserved, it didn't turn into a fossil. It was still, the tissue, et cetera, was still there. They were able to extract the blood out of this thing, and of course, this is science fiction. And that's the whole idea with these dinosaurs. They were able to get the DNA, and then they were able to grow these dinosaurs, actual dinosaurs. Now, that's the theory behind it. I had a feeling that was coming. So what you're raising is that very kind of question. And I mean, until this generation, nobody ever even thought of such a thing. What if scientists took DNA from the shroud or from one of these Eucharistic miracles? I'm not saying they should do this, believe me. What could that lead to? What would that mean in terms of, could there be living cells that came from Jesus? It's mind-blowing. And it's actually, it's almost something I don't even really want to think about, because knowing how reckless some people can be, I mean, I almost don't even want to think about it. And I really haven't thought about it until you raised this in the email. So I'm not sure what to tell you, but you're asking, is it possible that Jesus, that his own DNA could be determined on the basis of samples from these? I think the answer is yes, is what I'm leading up to. I think the answer is yes. We now have that kind of technology. But I must say, I feel very ambivalent about even trying to do that, because I don't know what that would lead to. And I'm not sure I want to know, but greater minds than mine are going to think about that. We're at a time now when we have the capability. So let's hope and pray that nothing untoward happens. Now, back to your earlier question about transubstantiation. It is true that in the miracle of transubstantiation on the altar, what once was bread and once was wine, when the priest, with the proper intention, using the proper form and matter, when he consecrates the bread and the wine, they do in fact become the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. This is not a symbol. It's really Jesus, substantially, sacramentally, really and truly present, but under the appearance of bread and wine. And so it tastes like bread after the consecration, just like before. It tastes like wine after the consecration, just like before. But with the eyes of faith, as St. Augustine says, we recognize that the reality, the substance in this case, is actually Jesus Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity. Now, in the cases where the Lord permits this kind of a miracle to take place, you'll notice that we don't consume those hosts. So in the case of the miracle of Lanciano, for example, and some of the other notable Eucharistic miracles where science has studied these things, and we know there's a certain blood type, and we know there's a certain cross-section of the heart in some cases, well, those are not consumed. Those are left as miraculous phenomena, and the church leaves it at that. But it would still be a transubstantiation. In other words, the very substance, and in this context, please understand that word substance, it doesn't mean like a sticky substance on your kitchen counter. That's not what it means. It means the reality of the thing itself. And the substance, or the essence, the reality of Jesus Christ is present in that host, and now in a way miraculously different from the typical miracle, which is that the properties of the bread and the wine remain. In this case, in the case of Eucharistic miracle, now the properties of human flesh and blood are now present. So it doesn't change the fact that the transubstantiation has taken place. It just means that in this miraculous fashion, for God's inscrutable purposes, he permits this particular host to have the characteristics of human flesh. You raise a very interesting and, quite frankly, mind-blowing question, Bernadette, and I appreciate that. I wish, you know, in a way, I'm very grateful that we live in a time when we have the benefits of so much wonderful medical science. We are all recipients of that, and we should be grateful for science and scientists and the state of the art of medicine that we experience right now. It's so unbelievable. But it carries with it a lot of frightening possibilities of using science in a way that could be, you know, really problematic, putting it lightly. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Let's go now to Christy in Jefferson, Wisconsin. Good morning,
yes,
Christy.
Hi, Patrick. I had a question about in Matthew chapter 12 when Jesus is talking to his disciples in like a house and they come to him and say, your mother and brothers are outside and wish to speak with you. And he says, who are, I don't know if I'm quoting it exactly correctly, who are my mothers and brothers? And he points to them and says, it's you, whoever does the will of my Father. How do you explain that? Because I've had a Protestant say, well, see, she wasn't that important because he basically shows you right there that we're all his brothers and women are mothers and yada, yada, yada. How would you
How would I respond to it?
Explain that. Yeah, how would you respond?
This is a common argument that's raised, and it's sad to me that people are, because Catholics recognize the biblical truth about Mary, and in the case of whoever the Protestant people may be, they're so intent upon trying to disprove the Catholic Church. Because keep in mind, that's what Protestantism is. It is a protest against what? Against the Catholic Church. And so they go out of their way, somersaults and mental gymnastics, to try to evade the clear meaning of the text. And this would be an example of that, where they see, look, here's something that kind of puts Mary down. That's great. How do we make some hay out of that? So let me read the passage. While he was still speaking to the people, this is Matthew 12, verse 46, behold, his mother and his brothers stood outside asking to speak to him. But he replied to the man who said, and someone told him, it says, your mother and your brothers are standing outside asking to speak to you. But he replied to the man who told him, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, here are my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my mother, or my brother and sister and mother. So far from being a put down, he's not putting Our Lady down. I mean, after all, the first thing you can say is, don't forget, Jesus is God. And God himself gave the commandment to honor your father and mother. So he's not going to break his own commandment. So if his commandment is to honor your father and mother, you can be sure that Jesus will fulfill that commandment perfectly. And so in a statement like this, Jesus is making a comparison. He's, in essence, what he's saying is, if you want to be my family members, if you want to be my brother, my sister, my mother, he's using these sort of analogous terms here, then do the will of my Father in heaven, which is to listen to me and to listen to those that I have appointed. So it's a juxtaposition that was intended to make a point about the reality of the kingdom and the reality of following Jesus, the reality of doing what God wants. He wasn't thereby putting Mary down. It was a point of comparison as a way to make the point about what I just said. So, I mean, that's the simplest answer to the question, and they may or may not accept that, but that doesn't matter. You know, the main thing is, remember what Our Lady herself said in Luke chapter 1 in the Magnificat. She says, behold, all generations will call me blessed. I had somebody say to me the other day, well, my Protestant friends don't like it when I say the Blessed Virgin Mary. I said, well, then you should point out what Our Lady herself said in the Bible. All generations will call me blessed. So every time you say the Blessed Virgin Mary, you're fulfilling biblical prophecy, as a matter of fact. Anyway, those are some thoughts, Christy.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. That helps.
You're welcome.
Happy to be
of service. Thank you. And I want to share with all of you a thought that occurred to me just the other day. And that is, you know how people will say, well, Jesus never said anything about homosexuality. And Jesus never said anything about, like, transgender stuff. You know what? It occurred to me all of a sudden, yes, he did. You're saying what? Yes, he did. And not just obliquely. In Matthew chapter 19, where he talked about how in the beginning God made them male and female. This is Matthew 19, begin in verse 1. Start reading in verse 1. In the beginning God made them male and female. And this is why God... this is how God made us male and female, and this is why a man leaves his family and clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. We've talked about that many times. It's the paradigm for human sexuality. But this was I don't know why I didn't think about this before, but all those passages in Leviticus and Deuteronomy about how a male should not lie with a male, for it is an abomination, nor should a woman et cetera, et cetera. I think you get the idea. Leviticus chapter 20, Leviticus chapter 18, those Old Testament passages. Jesus said those things because Jesus is God, and God was speaking these things to Moses. So did Jesus in the incarnation walking among us, you know, in his earthly ministry, did he say those words in that context? No, but it's the same person. This is the key to understand this. He's the second person of the Trinity. We believe in one God in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So in Leviticus 18, in Leviticus 20, in those passages in the Old Testament where it's really clearly stated, don't do that. Yes, that is Jesus speaking as the second person of the Blessed Trinity. So think about that, because you can't divide Jesus from God. He is God. That's the key. This is the key to the whole thing. Jesus is God. He's the second person of the Blessed Trinity. So if somebody says to you, well, Jesus never said anything, well, he sure did. And he said it in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 22, and Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13, etc. Try that on for size. Because the only alternative would be to say, well, that's just God speaking. Well, Jesus is God. Cyrus, you get what I'm saying, don't you?
Clear as a bell.
See what I'm saying? Stick with me. You never know what you might find on the Patrick Madrid Show. I have an hour to go. It's going to go quickly, and I'm going to go straight to your phone calls right after this. 888-914-9149.